This is Hybrid Teaching, Pedagogy, People, Politics, a serialized audiobook addressing the intersections of pedagogy and power in our connected and challenging education environment. It's the audio version of the open access collection of the same name, published in February 2021. The book features 27 chapters of provocative text addressing the intersections of critical pedagogy and digital technology in our present political moment. I'm your host, Chris Friend, from Kane University. I introduce your authors and read the occasional chapter. This podcast provides one more avenue for accessing the material from the book, which is also available as an ebook, a print-on-demand paperback, a series of articles published on the open web, and screen and print-ready PDFs available for free on Hybrid Pedagogy. This is Chapter 9 of Part 3 Politics, and you'll hear EdTech in a Time of Trump, read here by its author, Audrey Waters. The article was originally published on the 2nd of February, 2017, on Hack Education. It was republished in Hybrid Teaching with the author's permission.
Funny word, hope. Funny, those four letters used so iconically to describe a presidential campaign from a young Illinois senator, a campaign that now seems lifetimes ago. Hope. My talks, and I guess I'll warn you in advance if you aren't familiar with my work, are not known for being full of hope. Or rather, I've never believed the hype that we should put all our faith in, rest all our hope on, technology. But I've never been hopeless. I've never believed humans are powerless. I've never believed we could not act or we could not do better. There were a couple days following our decision about the title and topic of this keynote, EdTech in a Time of Trump, when I wondered if we'd even see a Trump presidency. Would some revelation about his business dealings, his relationship with Russia, his disdain for the Constitution prevent his inauguration? We should have been so lucky, I suppose. Hope. The thing is, I'd still be giving much the same talk, just with a different title. A time of Trump could be a time of neoliberalism, or a time of libertarianism, or a time of algorithmic discrimination, or a time of economic precarity. All of this, from President Trump to the so-called new economy, has been fueled to some extent by digital technologies, and that fuel, despite what I think many who work in and around education technology have long believed, have long hoped, is not necessarily, heck, even remotely progressive. I've had a sinking feeling in my stomach about the future of education technology long before Americans, 26% of them at least, selected Donald Trump as our next president. I am, after all, EdTech's Cassandra. But President Trump has brought to the forefront many of the concerns I've tried to share about the politics and practices of digital technologies. I want to state here at the outset of this talk, we should be thinking about these things no matter who is in the White House, no matter who runs the Department of Education, no matter even whether we have a federal Department of Education. We should be thinking about these things no matter who heads our universities. We should be asking always and again, just what sort of future is this technological future of education that we're told we must embrace? Of course, the future of education is always tied to its past, to the history of education. The future of technology is inexorably tied to its own history as well. This means that despite all the rhetoric about disruption and innovation, what we find in technology is a layering on to older ideas and practices and models and systems. The networks of canals, for example, were built along rivers. Railroads followed the canals. The telegraph followed the railroad, the telephone, the telegraph, the internet, the telephone, and the television. The internet is largely built upon a technological infrastructure first mapped and built for freight. It's no surprise, then, that the internet views us as objects, as products, our personal data as a commodity. When I use the word technology, I draw from the work of physicist Ursula Franklin, who spoke of technology as a practice. Technology is not the sum of artifacts, of the wheels and gears, of the rails and electronic transmitters, she wrote. Technology is a system. It entails far more than its individual material components. Technology involves organization, procedures, symbols, new words, equations, and most of all, a mindset. Technology also needs to be examined as an agent of power and control, Franklin insisted. And her work highlighted, quote, how much modern technology drew from the prepared soil of the structures of traditional institutions, such as the church and the military. I'm going to largely sidestep a discussion of the church today, although I think there's plenty we could say about faith and ritual and obeisance and technological evangelism. That's a topic for another keynote, perhaps. And I won't dwell too much on the military either, how the military-industrial complexes point us towards technological industrial complexes and to edtech industrial complexes in turn. But computing technologies undeniably carry with them the legacy of their military origins: command, control, communication, intelligence. As Donna Haraway argues in her famous Cyborg Manifesto, quote, "Feminist cyborg stories have the task of recoding communication and intelligence to subvert command and control. I want those of us working in and with education technologies to ask if that is a task we've actually undertaken. Are our technologies or our stories about technologies feminist? If so, when? If so, how? Do our technologies or our stories work in the interest of justice and equality? Or rather, have we adopted technologies for teaching and learning that are much more aligned with that military mission of command and control? The mission of the military, the mission of the church, the mission of the university." I do think that some might hear Haraway's framing, a call to recode communication and intelligence, and insist that's exactly what education technologies do, and they do so in a progressive reshaping of traditional educational institutions and practices. Educational technologies facilitate communication, expanding learning networks beyond the classroom, and they boost intelligence, namely how knowledge is created and shared. Perhaps they do. But do our edtech practices actually recode or subvert command and control? How do our digital communication practices differ from those designed by the military? And most importantly, I'd say, how does our notion of intelligence, and this is the one to watch and listen for, and yes, it is ironic that edtech in a time of Trump will be about intelligence, but hear me out. Intelligence means understanding, intellectual, mental faculty. Testing intelligence, as Stephen Jay Gould and others have argued, has a long history of ranking and racism. The word intelligence is also used, of course, to describe the gathering and assessment of tactical information, information, often confidential information, with political or military value. The history of computing emerges from cryptography, tracking and cracking state secrets. And the word intelligence is now used, oh, so casually, to describe so-called thinking machines, algorithms, robots, AI. It's probably obvious, perhaps when we think about the latter, that our notions of intelligence are deeply intertwined with technologies. Computing will make us smarter, you know those assertions. But we've long used machines to measure and assess intelligence and to monitor and surveil for the sake of intelligence. Again, let's recall Franklin's definition of technologies. These include not just hardware and software, but ideas, practices, models, and systems. One of the hot new trends in education technology is learning analytics, this idea that if you collect enough data about students, that you can analyze it and in turn algorithmically direct students towards more efficient and productive behaviors, institutions towards more efficient and productive outcomes, command, control, intelligence. And I confess, it's the phrase collect enough data about students that has me gravely concerned about edtech in the time of Trump. I'm concerned in no small part because students are often unaware of the amount of data that schools and software companies they contract with know about them. I'm concerned because students are compelled to use software in educational settings. You can't opt out of the learning management system. You can't opt out of the student information system. You can't opt out of required digital textbooks or digital assignments or digital assessments. You can't opt out of the billing system or the financial aid system. You can't opt out of having your cafeteria purchases, your internet usage, your dorm room access, your fitness center habits tracked. Your data as a student is scattered across multiple applications and multiple databases, most of which, I'd wager, are not owned or managed by the school itself, but rather outsourced to a third-party provider. School software, and I'm including K-12 software here alongside higher ed, knows your name, your birth date, your mailing address, your home address, your race or ethnicity, your gender. I should note here that many education technologies still require male or female and do not allow for alternate gender expressions. It knows your marital status. It knows your student identification number. It might know your social security number. It has a photo of you, so it knows your face. It knows the town and state in which you were born, your immigration status, your first language, and whether or not that first language is English. It knows your parents' language at home. It knows your income status, that is, at the K-12 level, if you qualify for free or reduced lunch, and at the higher ed level, if you qualify for a Pell Grant. It knows you if you're a member of a military family. It knows if you have special education needs. It knows if you were identified as gifted and talented. It knows if you graduated high school or passed the high school equivalency exam. It knows your attendance history, how often you miss class, as well as which schools you've previously attended. It knows your behavior history. It knows your criminal history. It knows your participation in sports or other extracurricular activities. It knows your grade level. It knows your major. It knows the courses you've taken and the grades you've earned. It knows your standardized test scores. Obviously, it's not a new practice to track much of that data, and as such, these practices are not dependent entirely on new technologies. There are various legal and policy mandates that have demanded for some time now that schools collect this information. Now we put it in the cloud rather than in a manila folder or in a locked file cabinet. Now we outsource this to software vendors, many of whom promise that because of the era of big data, we should collect even more information about students, all their clicks and their time spent on task, perhaps even their biometric data and their location in real time, so as to glean more and better insights, insights that the vendor will then sell back to the school. Big data. Command. Control. Intelligence. This is the part of the talk, I reckon, when someone who speaks about the dangers and drawbacks of big data turns the focus to information security and privacy. And no doubt, schools are incredibly vulnerable on the former front. Since 2005, U.S. universities have been the victim to over 1,300 data breaches involving more than 24 million known records. We typically think of these hacks as going after social security numbers or credit card information or something that's of value on the black market. The risk isn't only hacking. It's also the rather thoughtless practices of information collection, information sharing, and information storage. Many software companies claim that the data that's in their systems is their data. It's questionable if much of this data, particularly metadata, is covered by the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, FERPA. As such, student data can be sold and shared, particularly when the contracts signed with a school do not prevent a software company from doing so. Moreover, these contracts do not often specify how long student data can be kept. In this current political climate, EdTech in a time of Trump, I think universities need to realize that there's a lot more at stake than just financially motivated cybercrime. Think WikiLeaks' role in the presidential election, for example. Now think about what would have happened if the contents of your email account was released to the public. President Trump has made it a little bit easier, perhaps, to come up with a worst-case scenario when it comes to politically targeted hacks, but we might be able to imagine these in light of all the data that higher ed institutions have about students and about faculty. Again, the risk isn't only hacking. It's amassing data in the first place. It's profiling, it's tracking, it's surveilling, it's identifying, quote, students at risk, students who are risks. Back when I first started working as a freelance tech journalist, I interviewed an author about a book he'd written on big data and privacy. He made one of those casual remarks that you hear quite often from people who work in computing technologies. Privacy is dead. He'd given up on the idea that privacy was possible or perhaps even desirable. What he wanted instead was transparency. That is to know who has your data, what they do with it, who they share it with, how long they keep it for, and so on. You can't really protect your data from being out there, he argued, but you should be able to keep an eye on where out there it exists. This particular author reminded me that we've counted and tracked and profiled people for decades and decades and decades and decades. In some ways, that's the project of the census, first conducted in the United States in 1790. It's certainly the project of much of the data collection that happens at schools. And we've undertaken these practices since well before there was big data or even computers to collect and crunch it. And then he made a comment that even at the time I found deeply upsetting. Just as long as we don't see a return to Nazism, he joked, we'll be okay. Because it's pretty easy to know if you're a Jew. You don't have to tail Facebook. Facebook knows. We can substitute other identities here. It's easy to know if you're Muslim. It's easy to know if you're queer. It's easy to know if you're pregnant. It's easy to know if you're Black or Latino or if your parents are Syrian or French. It's easy to know your political affinities. And you needn't have given over that data. You needn't have checked those boxes in your student information system in order for the software to develop a fairly sophisticated profile about you. Think of a punch card, a paper-based method of proto-programming, one of the easiest ways in which machines could be automated. It's a relic, a piece of old tech, if you will, but also a political symbol. Think draft cards. Think of the slogan, "Do not fold, spindle, or mutilate." Think Mario Savio on the steps of Sproul Hall at UC Berkeley in 1964, insisting angrily that students not be viewed as raw materials in the university machine. The first punch cards were developed to control the loom, industrializing the craft of weaving women around 1725. The earliest design, a paper tape with holes punched in it, was approved upon until the turn of the 19th century, when Joseph Marie Jacquard first demonstrated a mechanism to automate loom operation. Jacquard's invention inspired Charles Babbage, often credited with originating the idea of the programmable computer. A mathematician, Babbage believed that number cards, pierced with certain holes, could operate the analytical engine, his plans for a computational device. We say most aptly that the analytical engine weaves algebraic patterns just as the card room weaves flowers and leaves, Ada Lovelace, Babbage's translator and the first computer programmer, wrote. But it was Hermann Hollerith who invented the recording of data on this medium so that it could be read by a machine. Earlier punch cards, like those designed by Jacquard, were used to control the machine. They weren't used to store data. But Hollerith did just that. The first Hollerith card had 12 rows and 9 columns, and data was recorded by the presence or absence of a hole at a specific location on a card. Hollerith founded the Tabulating Machine Company in 1896, one of the four companies consolidated to form the Computing Tabulating Recording Company, later renamed to the International Business Machines Corporation, or IBM. Hollerith's punch card technology was first used in the U.S. Census in 1890 to record individuals' traits, their gender, race, nationality, occupation, age, marital status. These cards could then be efficiently sorted to quantify the nation. The census was thrilled, as it had taken almost a decade to tabulate the results of the 1880 census, and by using the new technology, the agency would save $5 million. Hollerith's machines were also used by Nicholas II, the Tsar of Russia, for the first and only census of the Russian Imperial Empire in 1897, and they were adopted by Hitler's regime in Germany. As Edwin Black chronicles in his book IBM and the Holocaust, quote, "When Hitler came to power, a central Nazi goal was to identify and destroy Germany's 600,000-member Jewish community. To Nazis, Jews were not just those who practiced Judaism, but those of Jewish blood, regardless of their assimilation, intermarriage, religious activity, or even conversion to Christianity. Only after Jews were identified could they be targeted for asset confiscation, ghettoization, deportation, and ultimately extermination. To search generations of communal, church, and government records all across Germany and later through Europe was a cross-indexing task so monumental it called for a computer. But in 1933, no computer existed." What existed at the time was the punch card and the IBM machine, sold to the Nazi government by the company's German subsidiary, Dehomag. Hitler's regime made it clear from the outset that it was not interested in merely identifying Jews who claimed religious affiliation, who said that they were Jewish. It wanted to be able to find those who had Jewish ancestry, Jewish blood, those who were not Aryan. Hitler called for a census in 1933, and Germans filled out the census on pen and paper, one form per household. There was a census again in 1939, and as the Third Reich expanded, so did the Nazi compulsion for data collection. Census forms were coded and punched by hand, then sorted and counted by machine. IBM punch cards. IBM machines. During its relationship with the Nazi regime, lasting throughout Hitler's rule, throughout World War II, IBM derived about a third of its profits from selling punch cards. Column 22 on the punch card was for religion, punched at hole 1 to indicate Protestant, hole 2 for Catholic, hole 3 for Jew. The Jewish cards were processed separately. The cards were sorted and indexed and filtered by profession, national origin, address, and other traits. The information was correlated with other data, community lists, land registers, medical information, in order to create a database, a profession by profession, city by city, and indeed block by block revelation of the Jewish presence. It was a database of inference, relying heavily on statistics alongside those IBM machines. This wasn't just about who ticked the box that they were Jewish. Nazi race science believed it could identify Jews by collecting and analyzing as much data as possible about the population. Quote, "The solution is that every interesting feature of a statistical nature can be summarized by one basic factor," the Reich Statistical Office boasted. "The basic factor is the Hollerith punch card. Command, control, intelligence." The punch card and the mechanizing processing of data were used to identify Jews as well as Roma and other undesirables so they could be imprisoned, so their business and homes could be confiscated, so that their possessions could be inventoried and sold. The punch card and the mechanized processing of its data were used to determine what undesirables should be sterilized, to track the shipment of prisoners to the death camps, and to keep tabs on those imprisoned and sentenced to die therein. All of this recorded on IBM punch cards and IBM machines. The CEO of IBM at the time, by the way, was Thomas Watson. Yes, this is who IBM has named their artificial intelligence product Watson after. IBM Watson, which is partnered with Pearson and with Sesame Street to personalize learning through data collection and data analytics. Now, a quick aside, since I've mentioned Nazis. Back in 1990, in the early days of the commercialized internet, those heady days of Usenet newsgroup discussion boards, attorney Mike Godwin, quote, set out on a project of mimetic engineering. Godwin felt as though comparisons to Nazis occurred too frequently in online discussions. He believed the accusations that someone or some idea was Hitler-like were thrown about too carelessly. Godwin's law, as it came to be known, says that, quote, "As an online discussion grows longer, the probability of a comparison involving Hitler approaches one." Godwin's law has since been invoked to decree that once someone mentions Hitler or Nazis, that that person has lost the debate altogether. Pointing out Nazism online is off limits. Perhaps we can start to see now how dangerous, how damaging to critical discourse this even rather casual edict has been. Let us remember the words of Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson in his opening statement for the prosecution at the Nuremberg trials. Quote, "What makes this inquest significant is that these prisoners represent sinister influences that will lurk in the world long after their bodies have returned to dust. We will show them to be living symbols of racial hatred, of terrorism and violence, of the arrogance and cruelty. Civilization can afford no compromise with the social forces that would gain renewed strength if we deal ambiguously or indecisively with the men in whom these forces now precariously survive." We need to identify and we need to confront ideas and practices that are lingering legacies of Nazism and fascism. We need to identify and we need to confront them in our technologies. Yes, in our education technology. Remember, technologies are ideas, they are practices. Now is the time for the EdTech Antifa, and I cannot believe I have to say that out loud to you. And so you hear a lot of folks in recent months say, read Hannah Arendt, and I don't disagree. Read Hannah Arendt. Read The Origins of Totalitarianism. Read her reporting on the Nuremberg trials. But also read James Baldwin and realize that the politics and practices of surveillance and genocide isn't something we can pin on Nazi Germany. It's actually deeply embedded in the American experience. It's part of this country as a technology. Again, let us think back to that first U.S. Census back in 1790, when the federal marshals asked for the name of each head of household as well as the numbers of household members who were free white males over the age of 16, free white males under 16, free white females, and other free persons and slaves. In 1820, the categories were free white males, free white female, free colored males, and females and slaves. In 1850, the categories were white, black, mulatto, black slaves, mulatto slaves. In 1860, white, black, mulatto, black slaves, mulatto slaves, Indian. In 1870, white, black, mulatto, Indian, Chinese. In 1890, white, black, mulatto, quadroon, octoroon, Indian, Chinese, Japanese. In 1930, white, Negro, Indian, Chinese, Japanese, Filipino, Korean, Hindu, Mexican. You might see these changing categories as changing demographics, or you might see this as the construction and institutionalization of categories of race, particularly race set apart from a whiteness of unspecified national origin, particularly race that the governing ideology and governing system wants identified and wants managed, the construction of blackness. Quote, census enumeration is a means through which a state manages its residents by way of a formalized categories that fix individuals within a certain time and a particular space, as Simone Brown writes in her book Dark Matters on the Surveillance of Blackness. Making the census, she says, a technology that renders the population legible in racializing as well as gendering ways. It is, she writes, a technology of disciplinary power that classifies, examines, and quantifies populations. Command, control, intelligence. Does the data collection and data analysis undertaken by schools operate in a similar way? How does the data collection and data analysis undertaken by schools work? What bodies and beliefs are constituted therein? Is whiteness and maleness always there as the norm against which all others are compared? Are we then constructing and even naturalizing certain bodies and certain minds as undesirable bodies and undesirable minds in the classrooms, in our institutions, by our obsession with data, by our obsession with counting, tracking, and profiling? Who are the undesirables in edtech software and education institutions? Those students who are identified as cheats, perhaps. But when we turn the camera on, for example, with proctoring software, those students whose faces and gestures are viewed visually, biometrically, algorithmically as suspicious. Those students who are identified as out of place, not in the right major, not in the right class, not in the right school, not in the right country. Those students who are identified through surveillance and through algorithms as at risk of failure, at risk of dropping out, at risk of not repaying their student loans, at risk of becoming radicalized, at risk of radicalizing others. What about the educators at risk of radicalizing others? And let's be honest with ourselves. Ed tech in a time of Trump will undermine educators as well as students. It will undermine academic freedom. See Trump's tweets about Berkeley on February 2nd, 2017. What do schools do with the capabilities of ed tech as surveillance technology now in a time of Trump? The proctoring software and the learning analytics and the student success platforms all market themselves to schools claiming that they can truly see what students are up to. They can predict what students will become. These technologies claim they can identify a problem student, and the implication, I think, is that then someone at the institution fixes her or him, helps the student graduate, convinces the student to leave. But these technologies do not see students. Sadly, we do not see students. This is cultural. This is institutional. We do not see who is struggling. Let's ask why we think, as the New York Times argued today, we need big data to make sure students graduate. Universities have not developed or maintained practices of compassion. Practices are technologies. Technologies are practices. We've chosen computers instead of care. And when I say we here, I mean institutions, not individuals within institutions. I do mean some individuals too. Education has chosen command, control, intelligence. Education gathers data about students. It quantifies students. It has adopted a racialized and gendered surveillance system, one that is committed to disciplining minds and bodies through our education technologies, through our education practices. Along the way, or perhaps somewhere along the way, we've confused surveillance for care. And that's my takeaway for folks here today. When you work for a company or an institution that collects and trades data, you're making it easy to surveil people, and the stakes are high. They're always high for the most vulnerable. By collecting so much data, you're making it easy to discipline people. You're making it easy to control people. You're putting people at risk. You're putting your students at risk. You can delete the data. You can limit its collection. You can restrict who sees it. You can inform students. You can encourage students to resist. Students have always resisted school surveillance. But I hope you'll also think about the culture of school. What sort of institutions will we have in a time of Trump? ones that value open inquiry and academic freedom? I swear to you this, more data will not protect you, not in this world of alternate facts, to be sure. Our relationships to one another, however, just might. We have to rebuild institutions that value human minds and lives and integrity and safety. And that means, in its current incarnation at least, in this current climate, EdTech has very, very little to offer us.
That was EdTech in a Time of Trump, read by its author, Audrey Waters. The article was originally published on the 2nd of February, 2017, on Hack Education. It was republished in Hybrid Teaching with the author's permission. Audrey is an education writer, recovering academic, serial dropout, and part-time badass. Those are her words, not mine. I would have said full-time. Well, that's it for this episode. I'll be back with one final episode of this series, a bit of a colophon mixed with reflection, to wrap things up. This serialized audiobook version of Hybrid Teaching, Pedagogy, People, Politics is available wherever you find podcasts. I'm Chris Friend, collection editor, podcast producer, and host. I tweet at Chris_Friend and teach at Kane University in Union, New Jersey. The theme music for this project is Where Was I? From Lee Rosevere. That song, as well as the text and audio of Hybrid Teaching, are all licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, which means they can be reused with author acknowledgement. Licenses like these make multimedia works like this simpler to create, and I'm especially grateful to each of the authors for allowing their material to be reused in this format. And I'm also grateful to you. Thanks for listening.